This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
President Hinckley, as he dedicated the Kirtland site, said that nowhere else has deity visited the earth as often as he did here in Kirtland. And that's the thing, I think, most of all that marks the Kirtland sites and also the Kirtland Temple.
Coming up next, the Joseph Smith Tour in Ohio.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
As you'll recall, the staff and scholars of the Joseph Smith Papers went on tour back in 2006. They traveled through New England, New York, and Pennsylvania. And then they came here to northeastern Ohio. It was February the 1st, 1831, when Joseph Smith, with his wife Emma, having relocated from Palmyra, came here. On that evening, Joseph jumped from his sleigh and ran up into this building to greet Newell K. Whitney for the first time.
Mark L. Staker.
Joseph Smith arrives here in front of the Whitney store, goes in and introduces himself. And you remember, he says, I'm Joseph Smith, the prophet. The Whitney family invites him to stay in their home. And if you've been in the home, you can see what a sacrifice that was for them. There's only one small room on the main level. When they invited the Smiths to stay at their home, they moved upstairs with the children. And so it was a real sacrifice for them.
Now, it may be a curiosity to some of you why it is that certain church history sites are restored and preserved and others aren't. While here at the Whitney store, historic site scholar Don Enders gave the following insight to that question.
Donald L. Enders.
When I was privileged to come aboard and begin working with the restoration of sites, we had a large map of the United States. And in that map were some 200 or more pins. The brethren have said that the historic sites program of the church should include those sites which played a key role in the restoration of the gospel or in its ongoing mission. Kirtland is a significant place, as you well know. The first site which we really dealt with is this marvelous structure behind. Newell K. Whitney, thou art the man. In this great structure unfolded the concept of presidency of the church and church headquarters, bishop storehouse, etc.
This is the Isaac Morley farm just outside of Kirtland. It was here, later in 1831, that Joseph and Emma came to live.
Carl R. Anderson.
Well, we're certainly happy to welcome all of you up to the Morley farm. As visitors come through our Kirtland sites, many of them identify the Morley farm as the place that they enjoy the most. I think the outdoor nature of the experience is good. There's a wonderful spirit up here on the Morley farm. First section that came in Kirtland is section 41. And in section 41, the Lord commanded the church to build a home for Joseph in which he could live and translate. This is where they came and did it. And Father Morley moved over, and Joseph and Emma moved in with them. And then they constructed a small home, according to Isaac Morley's daughter. It was a small frame home with only a couple of rooms. This is where the twins were born and died. This is where the Murdoch twins were adopted. This was the first place that we lived the law of consecration.
It was on this property in June of 1831 in a small log schoolhouse that a memorable church conference was held.
This is one of the most important events in the history of this area. Joseph Smith, when he dictates his 1832 history, he lists five events, as you recall, that he saw as pivotal events. And he mentions the first vision, he mentions Moroni coming, and the translation of the Book of Mormon. The last of those five, and of course this is 1832, so he can't continue on, but the last of those is what takes place up here at the schoolhouse on the hill. They organize a conference, and that conference, Ezra Booth says that there's a preliminary meeting on June the 3rd, and Joseph receives a revelation at that preliminary meeting where he's told to give them the high priesthood.
And if you can picture this road, this was the main road to Menor. And the road we've walked up is the same road those early brethren walked on to where Joseph ordained the first high priest in that little log schoolhouse. 2.5 years later, up the trail, come Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff. They're now in Kirtland. And this is the Wilford Woodruff's account of when they went up to the log schoolhouse again. They sat down, and Joseph had them bear their testimonies. When they finished, Joseph said, "I've been very edified by what you have said." But he said, "I want all of you to know before God that," he said, "that none of you know the destiny of this church and kingdom. You don't comprehend it." He said that they didn't know any more than a babe upon its mother's lap. And then out of this schoolhouse comes the prophecy, "This church will fill North and South America, and then it will fill the world." And among other things, he said, "The saints will go to the Rocky Mountains and there build temples."
After leaving the Morley farm, Joseph and Emma Smith moved southeast of Kirtland to Hiram, Ohio. They moved here with John and Elsa Johnson.
Milton V. Backman.
So the John Johnson farmhouse for 6 months became a headquarters of the church. It would have been in the middle of September 1831, about a year and a half after the church was organized, that he came here. Now, why did he come here? I believe he wanted to find a place of peace away from administrative responsibilities, away from mob activity, because the Lord had commanded him to translate the Bible, and that was his major activity. This home is called the Revelation House. The only time probably in his life where he really placed himself in a position where it would be away primarily from other people. And there he just concentrated day after day dictating information by revelation, the Bible. So here Joseph and Sidney were day after day, probably in this room, working on the translation of the Bible. Now it was here then that Joseph received a number of major revelations.
Robert J. Woodford.
So he's here for approximately 6 months. During that time, 15 of the revelations that find their way eventually into the Doctrine and Covenants are received here in Hiram, Ohio.
Joseph Smith stood on the porch. Lorenzo Snow describes a Bowery that was here in the front yard, and he gathered with many members of his family when he first came and heard Joseph Smith preaching here on this stoop, and was profoundly influenced by the things that he heard from him. The Johnson family had a dairy operation here and were reasonably well off. This was actually the most valuable home in the entire county. Here, to my left, had been the bedroom of John and Elsa Johnson, and they gave that room up and moved over to another area of the home. And that later local tradition called this the Revelation Room or the Translating Room. It's also called, and that's apparently the work area where much of what Joseph did took place. And they probably slept in another area in the home.
It was here in this home, probably in this very room, where Section 76, the vision, was received.
It was a blizzard that day. It was slushy and very cold, and it had snowed for weeks before that and was quite cold on the day that he received that revelation. But apparently, during that period of time, information got out, and there's a brother Haskin who began telling people in different areas that he had been to Hiram, they said, and he's a brother, and he tells us that Joseph had a vision.
I'd like to read to you Brigham Young's reaction to that revelation. After all, my traditions were such that when the vision first came to me, it was so directly contrary and opposed to my former education, I said, wait a little. I did not reject it, but I could not understand it. The idea of one heaven and one hell was so deeply ingrained in the Christian theology that Brigham Young had to read it several times before he could accept it. And so the reaction to some of some people here is still a reaction that those who are schooled in Christian things would still have.
Well, after this information spreads, apparently people have a very difficult time accepting this. And a couple of weeks after Joseph receives the vision, he gets the first notice here that he is going to be mobbed.
It was here in the Johnson home on March the 25th, 1832, when some locals, including some who had family members who were Mormons, organized and attacked Joseph Smith. They tarred and feathered him.
He goes to bed with Emma, who's already expecting at this time a son that they'll call Joseph, and doesn't sleep well that night and seems to toss and turn. Across the street from us here, Sidney Rigdon and Phoebe also go to bed. They have six children who are also suffering with the measles. The mob divides into two groups. One goes to across the street to where Sidney Rigdon's at, and the other one comes and attacks Joseph here at the home. It appears to be a simultaneous thing. Joseph Smith, they pull out of the house. Some by his hair, others grab him. He says he comes awake immediately on the porch. And he kicks Warren Waste off of the porch into the street. Now, if you're thinking of this porch and that street, that seems to be an amazing feat. And so I'm just going to explain briefly that I think that it took place on the side porch, and there are a lot of little details as to that. I won't go into it all in a lot of detail, but there was a paved road that ran right here over to the stoop on the side, and there's a door from the summer kitchen that goes immediately outside. He says they take him around the house and out to where they try to choke him, and then take him down the street where he sees Sidney Rigdon being mobbed. And then Joseph says they take him another 20 rods into a meadow, and aerial photography suggests that the meadow is out down in this apple orchard here, where if you actually walk up the street, you can see where it slopes down in there to where the meadow is at. And they brutalize Joseph there.
Richard L. Bushman.
This event, as Mark was suggesting at the end, was the most severe violence that Joseph Smith had encountered up to that point, and probably affected his view of himself and his place in the world ever after. He'd been harassed, he had been verbally persecuted, ridiculed, but here he was physically brutalized in a number of ways.
Ultimately, the issue here was that the local members couldn't all accept this dramatic change in doctrine. They couldn't accept a living prophet who continued to give revelation, and the church would change in response to those revelations.
This is the Kirtland House of the Lord. It later came to be called the Kirtland Temple. Not only does this building represent the enlargement, the expansion, if you will, of Joseph Smith's view of earthly and heavenly things, but it also represents the dedication and the sacrifice of those early saints who labored to build it. This building is presently owned and maintained by the Community of Christ.
Joseph Smith never built chapels. He didn't build a chapel during his entire life. When the saints began to accumulated numbers in Kirtland, someone suggested, well, let's build a little meeting house for us, like all other growing congregations build little meeting houses. And he said, I have a better plan, and proposed this incredible structure, far out of scale for the saints' resources or for this little tiny town, this huge temple on the hill, which did indeed serve as a meeting house for Kirtland, for Far West, and for Nauvoo. And there the basic unit are houses, residences, and then a temple or temples at the center. That is basically how we conceive the church. And the fact that when we did develop congregations in Utah, they're called wards, which is a subdivision of a city, shows the precedence of a civic organization in Joseph Smith's mind.
There really wasn't much wealth in the area. And so Joseph said, now what's your idea of this building? And some said, oh, a log building, a frame building, you know. And Joseph said, you have no understanding. We're going to build a temple. A temple to the Lord. Now, can you imagine when Joseph began describing this building, three floors, to a handful of people who were living in the wilderness, and they were thinking in terms of a little log building? I mean, they just couldn't conceive of a structure such as this. So people gathered and they sacrificed. Instead of selling their property and coming here and building nice homes, they came here and lived in small huts. They created a shanty town, but that wasn't important. They lived in poverty, but they concentrated on building this structure. They gave everything, everything, their time, talent, material means. They sacrificed, and they accomplished what really seemed impossible. 3 years building a structure like this by a handful of people with very little money and without much knowledge.
Leishlon McKay.
The temple was built between 1833 and 36, and of course they were hoping to build bricks, but their bricks crumbled as they fired them, and they were soon in trouble. Not long after that happened, though, Artemus Millett arrives from Canada, a new member, bringing with him, it seems, a building technique new to the area. And his idea was to gather pieces of sandstone of various sizes and shapes. Using mortar to hold that stone together, they build a wall about 2 feet thick and about 45 feet high, and then immediately apply a hard plaster or stucco finish to the outside. So they apply this hard plaster or stucco finish, and they described it in the 1830s as blue in color, which I really think means a slate gray. They had sent out young people to gather old crockery and glass that was crushed even finer and dumped into the stucco so that when the sun hit it, it would sparkle brilliantly. And the front doors were restored just a few years ago to their original moderate olive green color. So it was a pretty colorful temple early on, unfortunately toned down through the years. But structurally, what you see today really survived amazingly intact.
Among those features of the Kirtland Temple that are the most recognizable are these pulpits. Now, while we don't know exactly what the letters stand for, there is some idea.
I'm going to actually start behind you, though, with the Aaronic priesthood pulpits. And on the bottom level is a PDA, which is a deacon's quorum presidency level. A PTA. Any guesses at what the T represents?
Teacher.
Teacher, sure. How about PAP?
Priest.
For the priests. And BPA?
Bishop.
For the bishops. I don't know, though, exactly what those letters mean. They either didn't write it down in the 1830s or it didn't survive. Here, PEM for the elders. Guesses on MHP? High priest, yep. Now for the bonus round. How about PMH? That's a difficult one, but the best that Carl Anderson and I can come up with, I think Keith Perkins would agree as well, probably the Kirtland High Council presidency, Kirtland State presidency. Then on top, an MPC for the first presidency.
Originally, the Kirtland House of the Lord had a series of curtains mounted. These were used to maximize space on the main floor of the temple.
Imagine canvas painted heavily white on both sides, as heavy as sails to a ship, operated like theater curtains. It's an 1850s description. They talk of ropes and pulleys and canvas and a wooden roller on the bottom of the canvas for weight. That would drop into the openings between the pew boxes that run east-west, as well as the openings running north-south. So one large worship space would become four small ones. They also could divide off around and between each level of the pulpits for privacy in which to study or pray. You see choir lofts in the corners, and those were most often used on Sundays. They'd actually come to this room on Sunday morning for hymns and prayers and sermons and testimonies. They'd break for several hours. They'd eat lunch. They'd come back for more hymns and prayers and sermons and testimonies. They'd serve what they called sacrament or communion or Eucharist. Then they would come back Sunday evening for choir practice. So you see those lofts in the corners, and they would sing from all four corners at the same time.
All of the temple's space was utilized, even up here on the third floor attic. It was here that later meetings of the School of the Elders were held.
All the way above us are five attic offices or schoolrooms. They opened what they called the Kirtland High School on the third floor of the temple, 1836 and 37. Their students ranged from age six, where they were learning what they called the first principles of education, how to read and write, all the way up to 30-year-old Wilfred Woodruff in the classical department, which was Latin and Greek languages. They also, of course, held a Hebrew school there, part of what they called the Kirtland, Ohio Theological Institution. They hired Joshua Satius to teach Hebrew there. Finally, Joseph Smith Jr.'s office, third floor, west end.
January the 21st, 1836. It was here, in this room, where Joseph Smith received a vision that came later to be known as Section 137 of the Doctrine and Covenants.
And I remember January 21st, the people prepared for one phase of an endowment. And they washed themselves, they cleansed themselves, and then they went upstairs in the third room, up in the west end room. And then they participated in anointing, and the heavens were opened. And Joseph saw in vision, and others saw the Father and the Son, Adam and Abraham, and Joseph's father and mother who were in town, and Alvin. And it was that seeing Alvin that led to this important question and great revelation. How can Alvin enter the celestial kingdom?
The remarkable experiences associated with the temple occurred because the prophet taught the saints of its sacred nature.
In the winter of 1836, as they're building up towards the dedication of the temple in late March, one of the items of business that occupied what seems like an inordinate amount of time was developing rules of conduct when you were to be, when you were in that temple structure. As these rules were presented, Joseph Smith made one of those comments that seems extravagant. What he said was, "Our rules will have a bearing, these little nine rules about playing on the stairs, will have a bearing upon all mankind and upon all generations to come." It seems disproportionate to make that heavy claim, a bearing upon all mankind and all generations to come, when you're talking about not carving up the benches. With these rules that Joseph was establishing for this Kirtland temple, he was beginning that process, which is extraordinary among the Latter-day Saints, of creating a sacred space. And I think the genius or the inspiration or the glory of our temples in creating sacred space begins with the prophet, who knew that these little rules about taking care would have implications for mankind for many generations to come.
With the temple's dedication right here, the promised endowment of power was poured out upon the saints.
Joseph would have been sitting second row from the top in the center as he stood to read the prayer of dedication, again, March 27th of 1836. Imagine for that dedication service, 900 to 1,000 people filling this room. They talk about pillars of fire on the roof of the temple and angelic choirs singing along with them during their services. They talk about this room being filled with the sound of a mighty rushing wind. The highlight of all of those, though, of course, April 3rd, 1836, the vision of the Lord standing on the breastwork of the pulpit, coming to accept to the dedication of the house. Breastwork is a term that means defensive barricade. So when they're talking about the breastwork, they're really just saying on top of the pulpit.
Just think of it. In the pulpits behind me is where the Savior literally stood. How many places can we go and pinpoint the spot where the Savior has appeared?
Marlon K. Jensen.
The first vision is the only known instance during the 10 years between 1820 and 1830 in which Joseph was privileged to have direct contact with these two members of the Godhead. But then, beginning in 1830, things picked up. And during the next 5 years, he saw both the Father and the Son on at least four occasions. On June 4th, 1831, in the schoolhouse on the Isaac Morley farm. In February of 1832, at Hiram, Ohio, Joseph and Sidney saw the Father and Son in the vision which has been canonized in Section 76. And then two reminiscent accounts from Zebedee Coltrane and John Murdoch, which document another appearance of the Father and Son to Joseph and to some members of the School of the Prophets in 1833. Finally, in January of 1836, here in this temple, as Brother Anderson has told us tonight, in administering the endowment as it was then revealed, Joseph had that marvelous vision canonized in Section 137, in which he saw the blazing throne of God, whereon was seated the Father and the Son. In addition to the four appearances of both the Father and the Son between 1831 and 1836, Joseph saw Jesus on four separate occasions. On that occasion, as Moses beheld the burning bush from the midst of which the Savior spoke, he was told, "Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the ground whereon thou standest is holy ground." Really it is. What we're standing on tonight is equally holy.
Notwithstanding the fact that this was holy ground, the Kirtland House of the Lord fell into disuse and disrepair after the saints were forced to flee. And then January 1838, Joseph Smith was driven out of Kirtland and he came here to Far West Missouri, about 900 miles away. Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, we go to Missouri. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.